Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, as the world remembers Chernobyl, Slovakia expands a Soviet-era nuclear reactor.
The general fear is there, of course. And we fear, for example, a meltdown, like in Japan or in Ukraine. For myself, I don't have a very good feeling about it.
A new climate credits program in France targets cows that pass gas.
Cows have a very slow digestive system, and when they belch and fart, they release methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that gets far less attention than carbon dioxide as a contributor to global warming.
And villagers in Myanmar protest against a Chinese mining project they say is polluting their lands.
The copper is also poisoning the community's rivers, Sumiul says. They used to be able to sleep without mosquito nets. But now the dirty rivers are attracting mosquitoes and disease.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. Let's travel back in time to April 26, 1986. We're in northern Ukraine, which at the time was part of the Soviet Union. It's a warm spring night. At the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, engineers are conducting a systems test on reactor number 4. There's a sudden power surge and then a series of explosions. The reactor is destroyed and burns for 10 days. It releases a cloud of radioactive particles that contaminate northern Ukraine, southern Belarus, and parts of Russia. The particles are blown out across Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, Britain. The list goes on. The Chernobyl disaster was the worst nuclear accident the world has ever seen. It drove thousands from their homes and triggered an epidemic of thyroid cancer in children. Over the past 3 decades, the economic losses, health costs, cleanup costs, compensation payments, and lost productivity have equaled billions of dollars. But the world needs energy. And governments are still drawn by the benefits of nuclear power. Nuclear fuel doesn't produce CO2. Despite catastrophes like Chernobyl and Fukushima, accidents at nuclear plants are actually quite rare. Storage and safety issues are still a problem, as is radioactive waste. But in an energy-hungry era, Europe is divided on nuclear power. Germany wants to phase it out, Britain wants to build it up, and we're going to take a closer look at a nuclear dispute which is heating up between Austria and Slovakia. Slovakia is buying up land so they can expand a Soviet-era nuclear power station, and a large majority of Slovaks support nuclear expansion, even those living close to the plant. For them, nuclear power means economic opportunity and energy security. They see a bright future in nuclear power, despite increasing anger from neighboring Austria. DW correspondent Carrie Skyring has this report.
A farmer plows a field near the village of Bohanice in northwest Slovakia. Looming over this peaceful scene are the huge cooling towers of the local atomic power station. It dates from the Soviet era. Two of its reactors have been shut down, but two are still running. And now the green light has been given for a new and much bigger Bohanice station. Rimo Cicuto is the mayor of the nearby town of Pieštanje. He also chairs the Association of Local Towns and Villages. Around Bohanice, he's one of the few people urging caution as Slovakia increases its dependency on nuclear power.
The general fear is there, of course, and we fear, for example, a meltdown, like in Japan or in Ukraine. For myself, I don't have a very good feeling about it.
Slovakia is no stranger to nuclear accidents. At Bohanice in 1977, a refueling error caused a major accident. It was hushed up at the time, but workers later revealed it came close to being a Chernobyl-style disaster. Slovakia also experienced the radioactive fallout from Chernobyl. Miro Cicuto is not sure why his country is eager to invest in new reactors.
I can't really explain it. That's why we've created this association of towns and villages in the vicinity of Bohanice, to make a plea to our government. We'd like to know about the advantages that come with enlargement, and we want to know the government's position.
Just 2 kilometers from the reactors, the village of Jaslovska Bohanice is well kept. It looks more prosperous than others in this part of Slovakia. At the local bus stop, youths hang out with their skateboards. Eric has grown up around here.
This nuclear power station here in Neselskoye Bohince is very big. It gives a lot of money to this village to improve it.
They're going to make it bigger. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I think it's a good idea because here will be a lot of workplace. It will be very good for these people.
This is an anti-Slovak nuclear power station protest, but it's in Austria, not Slovakia. The protesters from Greenpeace handcuff themselves together and block the entrance to a bank they say is funding the nuclear enlargement until the police arrive. Austria is strongly anti-nuclear, and Bohanice is just 1 hour's drive from its border. The government in Vienna often complains to the government in Bratislava about safety standards. But Slovaks seem less concerned.
So far, there's been so little discussion in Slovakia that there was no even space for any protests.
Andrea Zlatnanska from Greenpeace is one of a small band of people challenging the Slovak government's nuclear energy policies.
I spoke to a lot of people from the region, and they feel powerless. They don't think they can change anything, and they also think that this is what feeds them. They feel like they have to trust the government, that they are doing the right thing.
Andrea wonders why there are more protests against Slovak nuclear power in neighbouring Austria than Slovakia itself.
What I find interesting in the region is that there have been protests against storage of nuclear waste. However, they don't really protest against the actual plant. But I don't think they see the connection. So it's a vicious circle. If they will not stop the actual nuclear energy being produced there, they will not stop all the negative aspects of it coming to their region.
Slovakia's nuclear energy company is known as JES. They were not prepared to give a face-to-face interview on why Slovakia is expanding nuclear power, but gave a written explanation.
There exists right now no relevant alternative to nuclear power. Slovakia does not have so much potential to develop renewable energy that would cover all its needs in the future. Even countries that reject nuclear energy are ultimately unable to fully cover their energy needs to a significant degree from other sources.
Lack of information and lack of debate about nuclear power and its costs and dangers worry Rimo Cicuto, the mayor of nearby Pieštanji. But he admits that it brings benefits.
I can't say if people are for or against, but we all live from this energy, and the people are also aware of the advantages that these power stations bring. Take, for example, these cooling towers. They're used to provide heating for their homes.
And in Bohanice, I ask Maria, a local student, if she thinks nuclear energy is good for her town.
I don't know, I think it's good energy, but on the other hand, it's dangerous too.
Has it been good for this village?
Yes, my dad worked there, and a lot of members of my family work there too.
You've heard about the big accident at Fukushima in Japan. Do you worry about the safety here?
Yes. Yes, I'm worried about this.
And Maria's friend Eric reveals the dark humor that's developed in the shadow of the Bohanice towers.
We still, in Slovakia or in this village, we say that when this there will be some crash or accident or, I don't know, bomb, I don't know. And so we will be the first.
The new Bohanice power station is due for completion in 2025. At an estimated cost of around 6 billion euros. Kerry Skyring, DW, Jaslovska Bohanice, Slovakia.
A French company that makes feed for cows has launched a unique carbon credits program. Their plan is to reduce the amount of gas emitted from flatulent cows. Grass-chewing farm animals are often overlooked as contributors to global warming, but when they belch and fart, they emit methane, a gas that traps solar heat more efficiently than carbon dioxide. In France, cattle account for 5% of the country's overall carbon output. So we sent out Charlotta Lomas. She bravely entered the pens of some belching, gassy cows in Bordeaux to learn more about this climate protection program. You might want to hold your breath for this one.
It's feeding time in Lamplume on Jean-Marc Lafarge's farm in the southwest of France. He's rounding up his beige cows, who were eagerly shoving their way to the feeding barrier, clanking the metal gates as they squeezed their heads through to reach their food. Now, all this eating usually results in a hearty round of belching and flatulence, but compared to most cows, Jean-Marc's herd farts less.
We don't hear them fart. I haven't noticed it. Anyway, there is no smell.
Cow farts are enough to get anyone giggling, but cow gases are a serious environmental problem. Cows have a very slow digestive system, and when they belch and fart, they release methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that gets far less attention than carbon dioxide as a contributor to global warming. For farmers like Jean-Marc Lafarga, methane is no laughing matter. In order to do something about it, he has joined a feed program to help his cows emit less methane.
We feed our animals with foods high in omega-3, such as alfalfa, flax and green grass.
Omega-3 and omega-6 are fatty acids found in cattle feed. Scientific research has shown that an unbalanced mix of these fatty acids in animal feed make cows emit more methane. But French company Vallourec has come up with a solution. They have developed feed that gives the cows a more balanced diet. Instead of a corn and soy-based diet, the cows get a mix of alfalfa, linseed and grass. Jean-Luc Besset from Vallourec explains.
We realized there was a link between the release of methane and what the animal was eating. The more the animal ate rich food and food with an imbalance between omega-3 and omega-6, the more methane it released. A cow releases between 600 to 800 liters of methane a day. With our feed, we've reduced emissions by 20%.
These farmers aren't the only ones taking bovine burps and farts seriously. The UN has called for a tax on cattle emissions in order to reduce the environmental impact of cattle breeding. According to a 2009 report from the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, livestock are responsible for around 9% of human-induced carbon dioxide and 37% of methane emissions. In France, the methane emitted by ruminants such as cows, otherwise known as enteric methane, is responsible for around 5% of the country's greenhouse gases. Beef farmer Jean-Marc Lafarga is aware of the strain cattle place on the environment, which is why he joined Vallourec's Bleu Blanc Coeur program 3 years ago.
There is a moral incentive here, and in addition to protecting the environment, I have the satisfaction of providing a product to consumers that is better for their health.
Feed producer Vallourec has now created a financial incentive too. The company is offering carbon credit rewards for farmers who prevent methane gas from entering the Earth's atmosphere. For every measure of methane gas they save equal to 1 ton of carbon dioxide, the farmers receive a 100 euro credit. They can use this credit for discounts on other Vallourec products. So the farmers benefit, and so do the suppliers. An hour drive east of La Plume in the town of Montauban, 50 kilometres north of Toulouse, Michel Cantalouba produces milk under the guidelines of the Bleu Blanc Coeur program. Using the Vallourec diet, Michel was one of the first farmers to test the scheme in the southwest of France. Cantalouba says that in addition to the environmental benefits, the cow's milk tastes better and the overall health of his 70 Holstein cows has improved.
Alors. Elles sont moins malades, beaucoup plus résistantes.
They are sick less often, and they are more resilient. They recover from little problems more easily because omega-3 helps them fight diseases. This means we give them fewer antibiotics, and their fertility has significantly improved.
The French government and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change are supporting the gas reduction scheme. They require the farmers to follow strict guidelines and test their herd's methane output. Vallourec's representative Jean-Luc Besset explains how testing the milk enables them to measure the carbon output.
Ensuite, on a fait le lien entre la quantité d'acide gras saturé qu'il y a dans le lait.
When we analyze the milk, if there's a lot of fatty acid, we're able to estimate the amount of methane produced. This is the scientific explanation for the link between the production of milk, the production of saturated fatty acid, and the production of methane.
De lait, la production d'acide gras du lait saturé et la production de méthane.
So far, only Michel Cantalouba, Jean-Marc Lafarga, and a handful of other farmers in southwest France have joined the FEED program. But they are already seeing results. So far, the national scheme has managed to stop more than 8,000 tons of carbon from entering the Earth's atmosphere. That's something milk farmer Cantalouba feels tremendously proud of.
The farmer is seen as a major polluter. It's nice to be able to contribute and to say we're making an effort to do something. Doing something good makes us happy.
With the global production of milk and beef expected to double in the next 30 years, bovine births and flatulence will continue to wreak havoc on the climate. So cattle farmers can't afford to pass on their responsibilities by allowing their herds to pass gas. Charlotte Lomas, DW, Bordeaux.
Burma opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has come out in support of a government recommendation to allow a Chinese copper mine to continue operations. The Nobel laureate visited the mine, which is in northwestern Myanmar. Now, she admitted that the project fails to effectively protect the environment and won't provide broad employment for locals. But she still wants the mine to move ahead. She said the project will encourage foreign investment and help build a positive relationship with China. Environmental activists and people living near the mine have expressed anger over Aung San Suu Kyi's comments. They say the mine is polluting the land and causing illness. The protest movement against the mine is becoming violent. Last November, there was an 11-day occupation by protesters. It was broken up by police, who used smoke bombs laden with phosphorus, an agent used in weapons of war. Naomi Conrad has this report.
In the distance, two bulldozers are chewing their way across the ridge, methodically clawing huge shovel loads of reddish-brown earth from the ground in their search for copper. The valley below is strewn with discarded piles of earth. There's reddish dust everywhere. The dust has crept into the folds of Sumiu's dirty grey T-shirt and stuck itself to his worn flip-flops. It's covered his tiny hut, huddled beside a lopsided pile of sand. The dust is even floating in a small pond. Some 20 aluminium cans are rusting in the murky, reddish-brown water, slowly accumulating the copper that Sumiu sells on to a Chinese middleman every week to buy rice for his family.
I'm worried. I'm afraid my children might get sick.
The copper is slowly creeping into his children's bones, making them brittle, the 22-year-old says softly. He gestures to his three children, crouching by the side of the pond. His daughter peers through her older brother's legs, clutching at his frayed trousers, then quickly pulls back. The copper is also poisoning the community's rivers, Sumiu says. They used to be able to sleep without mosquito nets, but now the dirty rivers are attracting mosquitoes and disease.
We don't hate the Chinese, at least as long as we have enough to eat. But if there is no longer enough, we will hate them.
The bulldozers trundling along the ridge above are Chinese. They dug up the fields where Sumiu's father used to grow tomatoes, peanuts and chilies, leaving behind dust and sand. Like many major mining and infrastructure projects, the copper mine in Monyo in the northeast of the country is jointly operated by Chinese investors and the Myanmar Economic Holdings, a company run by the Burmese army. When the West imposed sanctions against the military dictatorship in the mid-1990s, European and US companies were forced to leave Myanmar. Chinese contractors stepped in, happy to exploit the country's jade and copper mines, chop down its teak forests and build its roads and harbours. China didn't share the West's concerns that under the dictatorship critical journalists disappeared and that students who dared to demonstrate were tortured. Farmers like Hussein Tong knew to keep their mouths shut when their lands were confiscated for the copper mine in Monyuan.
3 years ago, it was impossible to demonstrate because of the regime. If we had demonstrated, they would have put us in prison.
Ulsan Tong leans forward emphatically and angrily taps his green light against the bamboo mat he is sitting on. His green cheroot lies forgotten in a small ashtray. At first sight, there's nothing remarkable about Ulsan Tong's village. There's a tea house with rickety plastic chairs, a small shop and a handful of boys zooming along the main road on rusty motorbikes. But the village is only a few kilometres from the copper mine with all its reddish dust and sand. And today, the villagers are no longer willing to keep quiet. Every couple of weeks, they gather in the main square and make their way down to the mine to demand full compensation for their land. Myanmar's military regime is inching towards democracy. But villagers say that last November there was a brutal crackdown on demonstrators in Monywa. The military regime, it seems, is determined to protect its economic interests. There's little the opposition can do, says U Aung Kyaing.
We have to try to persuade them.
Persuade the military's echelons to give up their economic holdings, that is. U Aung Kyaing fingers the small red badge stuck on his shirt that marks him out as a member of the National League for Democracy, the NLD. He spent 16 years in jail for being a founding member of the opposition party that was long outlawed by the military. U Aung Kyaing's office in the former capital, Yangon, is uncomfortably hot and sticky. There's been another power cut. On the wall, there's a huge post of Aung San Suu Kyi, the NLD's leader, shaking President Obama's hand. A recent report on the copper mine compiled and presented by Aung San Suu Kyi said the mine should be allowed to continue operating to encourage foreign investors to help the lagging economy. The villagers were outraged. But U Aung Kyaing, too, hopes that the West will help Myanmar.
In the parliament, we adopted the Foreign Investment Development Law. We give many openings for the investments for Western countries and our democratic states like German, European and American. But so far, they did not come yet. To wait and see.
Ask Win Myo Tu about such hopes and Myanmar's leading environmentalist shrugs them off as naive. He's convinced that European or American companies are just as likely to pollute rivers, as long as there's no legal framework to prevent them.
There's so many cronies and rich people are the member of parliament, and they are in this ruling party, you know, USDP. And they're strongly against that because, you know, if environmental law is, you know, really promulgated and enforced, their business will be affected.
The government recently passed an environmental law, but Win Myo Tu says it is a mere farce. Less than 1% of the budget is allocated to the environment. He is afraid that China will hold on to Myanmar at all costs.
Every developing countries are very smart, you know, except for Obama. So once they know that there's a path to go, then everybody will try clean energy and clean product. Then they will find a country dumping ground to, you know, to sell their all dirty product and these unclean technology, you know, why they are moving forward, right? So Myanmar is perfect place for dumping ground because we are located within China, India and Thailand. They will sell all their obsolete, these stupid technology and product.
Myanmar, says environmentalist Win Myo Oo, desperately needs to build up an environmental immune system. Strong laws that are enforced, if needs be, against entrenched military interests. For DW, this is Naomi Conrad in Yangon.
Our final report on today's show takes us to Lake Chad. On a map, you'll find it at the intersection of four different countries in West Africa: Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon. It was the source of water for massive irrigation projects for many years, and it used to be one of the largest bodies of fresh water on the African continent. But levels have dropped by some 90%. Lake Chad is now a ghost of its former self. Experts are worried it could disappear altogether over the coming decade, and that would have a serious effect on the 30 million people who rely on it for water. Negala Kilian Chimtom has this report.
Approaching Lake Chad from Gulfi, a small area in Cameroon's far north region, the air is dry and dusty, and the winds are fierce. Vegetation here is sparse, without trees, and scorched shrubs break the sandy expanse every few hundred meters. Bordered by Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria, Lake Chad once spanned some 25,000 square kilometers, but in the last half century, it has shrunk by 90%. As a result of minimal rainfall, the two main rivers flowing into the lake are unable to feed it like years gone by. For generations, herders, fisherfolk and farmers have relied on the basin's rich soils and water supply for their crops and stock and an ample amount of fish. Now the lake is drying up before them. On the banks of the lake, Muhammad Abubakar is disentangling a tiny black catfish from a large net. He says things have changed dramatically in the past few years.
You know, before you needed to cast the net just a few times to get thousands of fish, but today it may require a whole day work to get this.
Fisherfolk are paid about $2 for such a haul. This will be Muhammad Abubakar's only income for the day. Back when the lake was healthy and teeming with life, the 64-year-old fisherman could earn as much as $50 a day. But as the lake's water levels continue to drop, Muhammad expects the number of fish he will be able to catch to drop even further in future.
Survival has become a real problem here because we don't have any other means of livelihood.
Sanusi Irman Abdullahi is the executive director of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, a regional body created by the countries bordering the lake. He says the shrinking of the lake is taking a toll on local residents. But it is impossible to blame the crisis on one single factor, experts say. Environmentalist Augustine Jamshi, the Central African representative from the Pan-African Climate Alliance, blames both human activity and climate change for the decrease in water at the lake.
It has to do with the agricultural practices there, the way people are using the water. But I think climate change is also to be blamed for the disappearance of Lake Chad.
He explains that water from Cameroon's Shari River, which provides over 90% of the Lake Chad's water, is being diverted to irrigation projects in the surrounding area. Sanusi adds that population pressure is also stretching the lake to breaking point.
40 years ago, the population within the Lake Chad area was about 17 million. Now we have about 30 million plus. So you can see there is demand by the human population, increase in animal consumption, of course, and then massive evaporation as a result of climate change.
For the time being, farmers and fisher folk are showing resilience, adapting as best they can to the situation. Amadou Bello, a fisherman in Gulfe, couldn't make a living anymore when fish stocks in the lake dropped. So he turned his hand to farming, growing crops such as cowpea, maize, rice and peppers. Showing off his thriving farm, he says the disappearing lake has left behind very fertile land. But if the low rainfalls continue, the remaining water will evaporate, leaving locals with few options for a livelihood. In an effort to implement more sustainable solutions, the commission has developed an ambitious plan to replenish the lake with water from the Ubangi, a tributary of the Congo River. He says the project will involve the construction of a dam in Palambo, upstream of the capital of the Central African Republic, Bangui. The water will then be channeled to the Shari River in Cameroon through a 1,350-kilometer canal and then into Lake Chad.
There's so much water in the Congo that goes into the ocean. We are just going to take a fraction of it to save the lives of over 30 million people. So the program is not only to bring water to Lake Chad, but also to improve the economic activity and the livelihood of the people within the Congo Basin.
According to Abdullahi, the scheme will cost a staggering $14.5 billion. Experts say the cost of the project may look frightening, but the cost of inaction is even more devastating. He predicts the lake could disappear altogether by 2025 if nothing is done to save it. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, DW, Yaounde, Cameroon. She shot me, she shot me, bang bang, she shot me, she shot me, she shot me, bang bang, she shot me, she shot me, she shot me, bang bang, she shot me, she shot me, she shot me, bang bang.
And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. For now, I'm Saroja Coelho. Thanks for listening.